Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I am doing fine.
And how was your Thanksgiving?
Wonderful.
Good.
Yeah, didn't go anywhere special, but a lot of nice experiences.
Nice.
Yeah. Lots of riding.
That was my next question.
Yeah, we had beautiful weather here in Northeast Ohio, up until Friday and Saturday.
Yes, when we were on our way home, we got slammed. Actually, it was one of the most harrowing trips I can remember when we hit Buffalo. The winds were just horrible off the lake. Terrible. Yeah, pretty scary. I even brought home a cold and a cough.
There you go.
Yeah, so I'm sorry if I sound a little bit weird this morning. I would like to take a moment to offer my deepest sympathies to my industry friend, Mark Ritz. His stepson, Petty Officer First Class Kevin Ebert, was killed in Afghanistan this past week. Mark and I have been friends for well over 20 years. I just can't imagine the heartbreak and anguish he and his wife are going through. Kevin was 32. He was a Navy SEAL, and he made the ultimate sacrifice. So I'm really, really, really sorry, Mark. And Charlie, I think his wife's name is. Yeah. Very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We will have some news this evening. Even though we're going to have a show, we are going to have some news because there's some important stories that I think you'll be interested in hearing. I'd also like to give a shout out to Jamie Fuller from Skins International for his unbelievable, unwavering commitment to cleaning up the sport. And we'll discuss more about that in our news segment. We have two great guests this evening. We'll begin with the president of Trek Bicycle Corp Company, John Burke. Simon & Schuster recently published his new book, One Last Great Thing. A story of a father and a son, a story of a life and a legacy. As the title suggests, the book is about John's father, Dick Burke, who was the founder, along with Bevel Hogg, of the world-famous company that has produced such bikes as the Y-Foil and the Madone, and ridden by some very famous people. John takes us through the last 2 months of his father's life and the legacy that the big guy, as Dick Burke was affectionately known by many who knew him, left to his family, professional, and personal alike. Then we're going to talk with Wade Barossi. He's a frame builder, a college instructor, which is very interesting, a seminar leader, and owner of Accel Corp. The company built the tubing, you know, those big fat aluminum tubes?
The beer cans?
Yeah. Well, Accel now has all that machinery. Mm-hmm. And they purchased that machinery when Cannondale was sold off to Dorel. And they're starting to do some interesting things. They produce also some joining products in addition to tubing. Wade will fill us in on his 20 years as a frame builder and what he sees as Accel's place in the growing artisan frame building business as well as for the bicycle industry at large. So grab a beverage, sit back, and let's welcome John Burke, president of the Trek Bicycle Company, to the Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. We haven't talked in a long time. The last time I saw you, I was in attendance at the Interbike Breakfast in September. At that time, I didn't know you were about to have your book, One Last Great Thing, published. Congratulations. It's a nice book.
Well, thank you very much. It was really good writing it, and the reviews that I've gotten on the book so far have been awesome, so I'm really thrilled with it.
Well, it is a quick read. I sat down and read it overnight, and I really got lots of history of the company, and really, I never met your dad, so it really was a good introduction to who he was, and just a sound like a really cool guy. I'd like to begin by asking you about your relationship with him. Seems like he had so much faith and trust in you and your abilities at a really young age. Was that a big part of who he was, trusting and supportive?
I would say trusting, supportive, and history would say smart. You know, it's very interesting with Trek as I started right when I got out of college. Went to school in Boston, came home, got my wisdom teeth pulled, and the next day I was at Trek for the one-day training program, and then I was out in Colorado selling stuff. And, you know, when I started with Trek, Trek was doing really well. And about the day after I started, it really started to go downhill.
So what year was that?
1984.
Okay.
End of May 1984. And I'll tell you, I had a front row seat for a year and a half of a very difficult period of Trek's history.
And what was going on at that time?
You know, Trek had grown like a weed. I mean, it was, you know, it had grown from nothing, and it was doubling its business and growing really rapidly. And all of a sudden, I started to join the company, and it came to a screeching halt.
And so,
we had some product quality issues, but mostly there were service issues. The bicycle retailers really didn't like Trek, and the people who were managing Trek at the time really didn't like bicycle retailers, and it showed. And, you know, I was out there driving around as a salesman, and so I was able to kind of watch the family business fall apart. And that, in retrospect, was the greatest education anyone could ever have gotten.
Sure. Out of failure, you know, you either rise like a phoenix or you disappear. So in the mid-1980s, they were steel bikes, as I remember, still then. Were you making aluminum yet?
You know, the first aluminum bike, you know, Cannondale had built some aluminum bikes in the probably late 70s and early 80s. And Trek came out with the first bonded aluminum bikes in the summer of 1985.
Okay, so that was right around that same time.
The Trek 2000, and that was kind of a revolutionary bike of the era.
Well, I remember my favorite, I will tell you what my favorite Trek model was. It was the red Shimano 1500.
You know, and that was a great bike, and that came out of that Trek 2000 product introduction, the 1500. There's a beautiful white and blue faded 1500 that was one of my all-time favorite bikes, but there are a lot of really good bikes there.
What was the problem service-wise with the bikes? See, I don't remember that.
It wasn't a service problem with the bikes. It was within the company. You know, dealers would need a credit. Credit would get lost. They'd put in an order for a shipment. It would arrive 3 weeks later. It was just, you know, fumbling on the basics.
What I got out of the book was that your father was a pretty meticulous guy about business. How did all that happen?
You know, he started out and he owned a distribution company that distributed appliances and, you know, lawnmowers and things like that. And that company grew, and it was really big, and that's how Trek got started, because he wanted to distribute bicycles, but he couldn't find a brand, so he created a brand. But he spent all his time in the distribution business, and he only provided some guidance to the bicycle business in the early days. And in 1986, he came in and he fired the management, and he took over day-to-day operations. And you know, one of the great things about my dad is he was an incredible listener, and he listened to customers and he gave the customers what they wanted. And that, if people look at Trek's success over the years, it comes from a very basic philosophy of listening to customers and giving them what they want and then giving them more than what they want.
Well, let's keep going with a little bit more in the book. You guys started doing some really cool things together, like running and triathlons and, you know, just things I just can't even imagine my dad ever would have done. He was a golfer. But yet here was this man who just was active in everything.
You know, it's funny because he was a, in 1972, he was probably 30, 40 pounds overweight, and he smoked a pipe every chance he had.
Huh.
And all of a sudden, Frank Shorter won the Olympic marathon in Munich, and my dad got into running. And all of a sudden, he'd run out to the end of the road and back, and then the next thing he knew, he was running around the lake, and he was right on the first wave of the running boom. And he got healthy, and that's one of the reasons he got interested in cycling. But he and I did some great bicycle trips. We did one of the first triathlons in the state of Wisconsin. I'll never forget it because he almost drowned in the lake. I mean, he was in, he was in big trouble there. And then over the years, he and I ran the Boston Marathon three times, and, you know, we did a whole bunch of different events together.
The way you detail each of those things that you did together in the book, it was just amazing. I learned so much about your company, but what I really learned was what a cool guy he was. How did he get the name the Big Guy?
Well, you know, the thing is he was, I always had different nicknames for him growing up, but one time I had the nickname Mr. Goodwrench because there was a commercial on at the time from Goodwrench, and Mr. Goodwrench was the guy you'd call to ask all your mechanical questions.
Right.
And our family knew nothing about mechanics, and so we called him Mr. Goodwrench.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was only 5'8". But he had this huge personality, so I started calling him the Big Guy. And he liked that name, and maybe about 10 years ago, he was the chairman at Trek. There was a large printing company outside of Milwaukee, and he became the chairman of Quad Graphics after the founder had passed away. So I started calling him the chairman. And that lasted one day, and I'll never forget, the meeting ended, and he called me over into the corner, and he said, Mika, he said, you know that name, the Big Guy? I really like it. So we kept with the Big Guy.
There's so many good stories that you told about your dad. He just seemed like such a great guy. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with John Burke. He is the president of Trek Bicycle Company, and he's written a new book called One Last Great Thing, a story of a father and a son, a story of a life and a legacy. When was it that your dad first became ill? What happened?
You know, there's an old story that he and I were running one day, and this was a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, and he told me I was in charge of his affairs if anything should happen to him. And if there was ever a medical decision to be made, he wanted to live an active life, and that if he couldn't, I should pull the plug. And I said, yeah, whatever. And it was in that fall of 2007, he told me that when he was running, he was short of breath. And he went to the doctor, and they checked, and he had a problem with one of his valves. And so he went in for heart surgery to get a valve replaced. Routine surgery, you know, it was 1 in 100 has a problem, and he ended up being the one.
Wow. Wow. And he spent the last a little over two months of his life in the hospital.
Yeah, he spent his last 88 days in the hospital, and all of those 88 days hooked up to life support.
And that is a big part of the book, is that last 2 months of his life.
You know, the book is really an incredible book, and it appeals to anyone. And the feedback I've gotten has been amazing from all sorts of different people, because it tells a bunch. It's not a history of Trek, but it tells a bunch of wonderful stories about Trek.
Right.
It tells a lot of great stories about a father and a son, but it also shares the inner story of his fight for life and how my family dealt with it, and ultimately how he dealt with death and how our family dealt with it. And this is an extraordinary man who accomplished some amazing things in life, but he saved his best act for last.
So he seemed like the glue that kind of held your family together.
He was.
Yeah. What was the most memorable thing for you about that time that he was in the hospital? I mean, you tell some amazing stories of, you know, people laughing and people crying. It's just unbelievable.
You know, there's so many stories about those 88 days, and that's why I ended up writing the book. And I only wrote the book for my two kids because it was the most moving experience of my life. And I wanted them to understand how moving those 88 days were and what a legend their grandfather was. And when I got done writing the book, I, you know, shared it with about 10 people. And and 9 of them came back and said, I read it in one night and I cried. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good book. So I gave it to a publisher and they wanted to publish the book. And that's really how I decided to do it. But I would say the most amazing part of those 88 days was the last day. And I spent an hour with him, the second hour before the plug was pulled. And it was the last hour I would spend with him, and I wanted to make sure it was our best hour. And so the night before, I had put together our top 20 memories. And so that hour that I spent with him, you know, I went through each one of those 20 memories, and we had, that was the best hour we ever spent.
Well, and didn't he, even though the plug got pulled, he just hung on.
It was, you know, this guy, one of the reasons he was called the big guy is he was 5'8", and he always had something to prove. And I really believe that when the plug was pulled, the doctor said he would last 5 or 10 minutes. And then he lasted a half an hour, and then it was an hour. And I said, this is going to go on for quite some time. And so I thought, what would he like? And I sent two of my brother-in-laws out to get a case of beer. And we sat in his hotel room in the ICU, probably 14 family members, and we drank beer and we read all the cards and letters that had flowed in. And I really believe the guy who was supposed to last 5 minutes, he ended up lasting over 9 hours. And I think it was his final marathon. He loved to run marathons, and I think he was just making his last point.
Which was pretty potent, I would say.
So, yeah, it was, you know, the other thing which is really weird is I would write these letters to inform everybody how he was doing. So I was in the room with him, and it was at about 7:30, and I was there with my wife and my sister Kathy. And I started to write the final note that would go out that night to let people know that he had died. And as a placeholder, I put, you know, at 10:59 this evening, the big guy passed away. And I went to sleep at about 10:30, and my wife woke me up at 10:55 to tell me he was going, and he ended up passing away at 10:59.
Okay, now you're a prophet. That's bizarre.
It's bizarre.
Except that it's not. You know, the universe works in such strange ways.
Yeah.
So if your dad were alive today, with all the stuff that's been going on this past year, what the hell do you think he would say?
You know, he loved life, and he loved all the action. And if he were here today, he missed out on the financial crisis, which he just would have loved.
Really?
He would have loved that. And he missed out on an African-American being elected as the president of the United States.
True.
He missed out. If you look back, there's so much that happens. And, and there's so much that has happened at Trek. I mean, Trek has grown quite a bit. We've introduced some amazing products. The company is humming, and he would be proud of that.
What do you think he'd say about what's going on in cycling today?
Oh. Well, you know, he loved a crisis.
Okay.
That was his, you know, the bigger the crisis was, the better he was.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he was a man of contradictions, and he loved the crisis, and, you know, he'd be the calmest guy in the room, and he would say, you know, this too shall pass.
Which is a very interesting perspective because, in fact, of course it will. You know, eventually it's going to fade away.
Well, you know, Will, and the thing about cycling is at its core, and anybody who rides a bike understands this, is at its core, cycling is just amazing. I mean, the joy of going out and riding your bike doesn't disappear. It only gets better with time.
I would agree with that. Absolutely. Well, is there anything that's happened in the interim since you wrote the book that I don't know about? You know,
I would say, you know, the only thing is just all the feedback that I've gotten on the book, and it just the amount of letters and emails that I've gotten from either fathers who had, you know, sons who have great fathers. They say, I read that book, and I'm going to sit down with my dad, and I'm going to tell him about my top 20 memories.
That's
or
cool.
People who say, you know, I didn't have such a great dad, and I read that book, and now I'm going to make a few changes, or I'm really going to work on this or that. And anybody who reads this book will be touched. It's available on Amazon. It's available on Apple, Barnes & Noble, or I think you can go to trekbikes.com.
It is a good book, and I have a copy. And in fact, and I'll tell you a little story. Your publisher, Simon & Schuster, sent me one unsolicited. I didn't even know it was coming out. And I actually sent her a note and thanked her for it. And she said, would you like a second one to give away? And so here is what I'm doing. We have a food bank fundraiser that our shop puts on every year. It's next Monday, and this is going to be one of the auction items, is a copy of One Last Great Thing.
That's awesome.
So he lives on.
Well, you know, that's the final thing, and I think this is important for anybody who has a loved one that is dying. Is a great friend of mine told me before he died, she said, his body will die, but his spirit will live on.
And that is so true.
And that is so true. And every day, physically, he's not here, but his spirit's here every day.
Well, John, thank you so much for sharing the story. One Last Great Thing, a story of a father and a son, a story of a life and a legacy. It's published by Simon & Schuster, John Burke, Trek Bicycle Company. Have a happy holiday season. I'll see you. Are you going to be at the Bike Summit?
I will be at the Bike Summit. I will see you there. And thank you so much for having me tonight.
It was my pleasure.
All right.
A great night. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
John Burke is the president of Trek Bicycles and the author of a new book, One Last Great Thing.
Yes, indeed.
Joined us from Wisconsin, I presume.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's at home in Wisconsin.
Well, let's take a break here.
Okay.
It's getting close to the halfway mark. And when we come back, we're going to jump into some news.
We are.
And then talk with a gentleman about tubing.
Tubing.
All right.
All right.
We'll come back with all of that right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Nurse, set up an IV. And you, her boyfriend, you were the driver?
Yes, doctor, but I didn't mean to hurt her. I only had a few drinks. I was just buzzed.
Just buzzed? Oh, then your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie, I feel great.
She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No, not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, getting ready to head into the second half of the show, and we'll start with some news.
And we do have some news. So my first item, even though it seems like we've beaten the UCI issue to death, is a new effort that was launched last Thursday and will be followed up next Monday with a publicly broadcast summit in London, attended by many of the players who want to see real change in the UCI and cycling. Once again, Jamie Fuller is at the forefront. He is the president of Skins International. He has enormous support and backing from the likes of Greg LeMond, Jonathan Vodders, retired Navy cyclist, Dr. Gary McKay, and many others. The new organization is ChangeCyclingNow.org. It will unveil its charter of principles, as well as lay out a 3 to 5 year plan for what they want to see accomplished to clean up and move cycling forward. I spoke with Jamie this week. We had another little Skype interview, more like just a conversation. One of the things he said to me really rang true, though, and that is that there is a very specific role that sports play in society, and that many kids get their values and ethics through sports in which they engage. And I thought that was a very interesting insight. So if you want to know more about ChangeCyclingNow.org, It's facebook.com/changecyclingnow or changecyclingnow.org.
I'm glad to see that some organizing is taking root and some people willing to step up and keep the pressure on.
Right.
To make those changes, because it would be very easy to just kind of let this whole thing soak into the ground.
Well, that's what's happened
dissipate.
For years and years and years.
Right.
So, you know, so it's very exciting.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't want it to fade away. You have one.
I do. You know, while you were out of town, the city of Cleveland lit up their Christmas tree down on Public Square.
As they last usually
weekend.
Do every
yes.
year.
And in the Plain Dealer, they had a nice article, you know, talking about the arrival of Santa and all the things and everything. And it's a great display. If you're in the Northeast Ohio area, you've got to cruise through downtown and see the lights.
Tree. Yeah.
Yeah, and the public square lit up.
Well, remember, General Electric is here.
That's right. And then uh-huh. GE ties into this. So the big tree was lighted by the leg power of 160 riders who took turns pedaling 7 stationary bikes starting at 5:30 a.m. 12 hours of riding powers the tree's LED lights for 100 minutes, which commemorates the 100th anniversary in Cleveland of General Electric, which has donated the city's Christmas lights for 40 years, and this year has contributed 400,000 LED lights.
Wow.
Andrea Tiemann, the GE employee who came up with the bike-a-thon idea, said it demonstrated the efficiency of LEDs. Incandescent lights on the tree would have needed 188 hours of pedaling
wow.
instead of just 12.
So where did the cyclists come from? Who were they?
Don't know. The article doesn't say.
What a great idea. That's so cute. Did you ever see the YouTube video of there were these pink stationary bikes in France? And women came up to them because they were pink and they would get on them and they started riding them. And this LED figure started coming up on the wall in front of him, and it turned out to be a guy, and he was like taking off his clothes. It was hilarious. It's a wonderful video, and the music's great. That's really cool, though.
Yeah,
I know. You can go to Neela Park and always see a beautiful GE display,
yes,
too.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Have you ever wanted to go to Interbike?
Not particularly.
Okay.
I live vicariously through you. That's enough. Thanks.
Well, a lot of consumers have wanted to go. And after more than 2.5 decades, Interbike will finally be opening its doors to consumers on the final day for 2013. In a conference call for the media on November 26th, the announcement was made by show director Pat Hoos, who explained how it would work. Dubbed quote-unquote Interbike by invitation, all registered bicycle dealers will be encouraged to invite their best and most loyal clients and customers to the show for the final day, Friday, September 20th, where show hours will be extended to 6 p.m. That usually closes at 4 on Fridays. There will be a per-customer ticket price, which can be subsidized by the dealer or paid by the customer, and it can now become a perk for your best customers. It's been a very controversial subject because of pricing concerns, that the public will learn all about the wholesale pricing of product. Frankly, I think consumers know all about it anyway, and if they choose not to buy from a shop because of price, knowing it ahead of time isn't going to make any difference. They would have either bought online or from a discounter anyway. There will be no products sold on Friday, though. It's a look, touch, and walk away day only. So it's the first time. We'll see how it goes.
Hmm.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. We actually know that a lot of consumers have, quote unquote, snuck into the show.
Mm-hmm.
But opening it up, I think it's going to be, it's sort of like legalizing it. It'll
yeah.
be good.
Yeah.
It'll be good. Have you ever traveled through Arizona on a bike?
Not on a bike.
Well, evidently, one of the ways Adventure Cycling Association is getting information about riding through specific areas is from the state's departments of transportation. And in the case of Arizona, there is interest in the economic impact of having bicycle travelers come through the state. And that is data that would tell a good story to legislators, city planners, and departments of tourism. So if you've been through Arizona on a bike in 2012 and you feel like you have something to contribute and want to take the study, it's www.surveymonkey.com/s/bicycle_event_participant_survey. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Okay.
Do you like funny videos?
Depends.
Okay. This is a short one. It's like 8 seconds.
I'll let you know whether it's really funny, okay?
Well, you can go look at it if you want, because I know you're right. It's CHOP, CHOPMTB.com.
Okay.
All right. So it's old footage, it turns out, but it is hilarious. Our friend Hans Ray was showing how to open a beer bottle with a spinning front wheel. So he turned the bike upside down and he spun the wheel really fast and he stuck the bottle in there. Mm-hmm. Well, it is hilarious, not to mention that the cap of the bottle came back and hit him in the face. But the feature the video is featured along with two other must-see MTB videos of the week at chopmtb.com. It's a good thing he had good reflexes, because I'm telling you, it almost put his eye out. Mm. It's just fun. If you want to laugh, evidently this chopmtb.com puts up 3 funny videos a week, and it's mostly mountain biking. But this one was hilarious. It was just hilarious. All right, I have one more. Maria Rodale.
Of the Rodale family?
Yes, she is the daughter of Robert Rodale, who passed away tragically many years ago now. She also is the CEO of this vast publishing Rodale empire, mm-hmm. which also includes bicycling. On November 19th, the Huffington Post published a piece by Maria that pretty much sums up her current thinking about bicycling on many fronts. Maria Rodale grew up near the Trexler Town Velodrome, and her own daughters are doing the same, getting on the track, falling down, getting back up. Here's an excerpt from her HuffPost piece. "Racing is a beautiful sport to watch, but that's not why my dad built a velodrome and bought Bicycling magazine. He did it because he wanted to see more people riding bikes, because cycling is healthy, because it's cleaner than driving, because it's beautiful and fun. You don't need dope to reap those benefits. I actually see the fall of Lance as a perfect segue into a new era of cycling, one that embraces women racers and riders, one that's more welcoming to outsiders and is humble, one that celebrates the joy and romance of the sport and the activity without the testosterone-driven, chest-thumping, ego-fueled, false hero-worshipping, win-no-matter-what attitude, the pukey part. But I could just be dreaming. This summer, all 3 of my daughters suddenly woke up with the fever. My oldest rode in her first race. My teenager goes out for bike rides after school just for the fun of it. And no, she's not riding to the store to buy cigarettes the way I did when I was her age. And my 6-year-old learned to ride on the velodrome in their Pee-wee Peddler program. I saw the fever rise right before my eyes. Her intense focus, the falling off and sliding down the track, and being more eager to get back up on the bike than to find a Band-Aid for the track rash. She has pink and white streamers that fly in the wind when she's going fast, and a basket too. Cycling will never be the same, thank God. You all can wait for your apology from Lance, and the fanatics can cling to their Omerta traditions, but there's no future in it. It's the obsession with winning that creates a culture of cheating and lying, whether it's the Tour de France or any other event in the sport. Any one of us who participates in the code of silence is complicit. I dream of a day when we worship sports heroes, not for their physical prowess alone, but for their integrity too. I dream of a day when we celebrate people, not just for world record-breaking times, but for their courage and positive attitude as well. I dream of a day when the truth is easier to tell than a lie."
Yeah, that's sound advice.
Yeah.
You know, nothing wrong with going fast, but don't kill yourself to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. So on that note, I think that's a nice sort of holiday-ish note, too.
All right.
The news.
Okay, wrapping up the news and moving on to talk with
Wade Barosi. Wade is a frame builder. He's a teacher who actually teaches welding and brazing to young people in college and high school. And he is also the owner of Accel Corporation and Cycle Design. Wade, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me, Diane. I've been a big fan of your show.
Thank you. We like to hear that. So you really have an interesting story to tell about your connection to the bicycle industry and to bicycling in general. Would you fill us in on your background and how your work evolved in the bicycle industry?
Sure. Well, I started out as a teenager working in bicycle shops, riding a bike since BMX as a kid. And over that time, I developed an interest in frame building. And at that point, this is the pre-internet days, so there was very little information available. So I pretty much had to figure out things myself.
So you didn't actually go to one of the people you're on the East Coast, like Bill Boston or one of those guys?
No, not at that point. I hadn't heard of any of those folks.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So it was a matter of just figuring things out from scratch myself. And it was only when I happened to stumble by somebody with a Tom Kellogg bicycle, Spectrum, that I even realized that there was a U.S. manufacturing scene.
Yeah.
And that sort of opened my eyes to you remember the Italian bikes of that time period. Well, their paint was horrible and their brazing wasn't very good. And for things that held in such a high esteem, it was fairly shocking. And then you see a Tom Kellogg bike coming by, and it's like, wow, this is a masterpiece.
That's true.
And that really woke me up. He was just the first frame builder I was exposed to.
And when was that?
Oh, that had to be late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, okay. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, long time.
And then what?
Then I went to work in bike shops for about a dozen years, learned how to fit people and sort of developed a philosophy on bikes and such. And then I went to college and worked bike shops through college and sort of studied a mixed curriculum of engineering, biology, and chemistry, which relates real well to bikes and not very well to anything else.
Yeah. It is an interesting phenomenon how many engineers there are in our business, isn't it?
Yes, and also biology majors. Look back through your records. You know?
Yeah, that's true. And artists.
Yeah.
There are a lot of artists, you know, sculptors and painters. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's something about the individualistic personality types or something.
Yes, I would say that. So at what point did you actually begin building frames? Because you built frames for like 20 years.
Yeah, I built my first one in 86 or 87.
Okay.
Which was mostly a disaster, but it taught me a lot.
Yeah.
And been gradually improving ever since.
So are you still building frames?
Yeah, I try to build 12 a year, something like that.
Oh, that's nice. And do you build them under a specific name? What's the name?
Barossi.
Okay.
My last name.
Very cool.
Mostly friends and family sort of thing. I don't have the production capacity to get very far beyond the local circle.
Well, one of the things I didn't know about you until recently is that you actually teach at a technical college in Connecticut.
Yes, Naugatuck Valley Community College. It's a fairly progressive state college, and they have a very good welding program, also a good automotive technologies program, as well as engineering and other various fields.
So you teach welding?
I teach automotive welding, basically teach auto mechanics and auto body people to weld, and also manufacturing education, so that the engineers and manufacturing engineering program students come through, and we introduce them to the various modalities and how to weld and all that. It's also a high school program with a pre-manufacturing certificate program that I work with.
So do any of these young people go on to bicycle building out of that program? I mean, they do know what you do, I assume.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I tend to... My whole presentation, my whole life is centered around bikes, so it sort of makes sense to put it into a bicycle context. Especially, it's something they can understand. Everybody knows what a bicycle is, what it does. They don't necessarily know anything about how to put them together.
Right.
But the basic skills involved in putting one together are the joining skills are certainly covered.
So I want to talk a little bit about your philosophy on bicycle design, because obviously you've been building bikes for a long time. And if you're brazing and welding, that tells me you're probably using metal like steel for the most part. What is your philosophy about bicycle design? What kinds of frames are you building? And, I mean, do you have a specific type of frame that you specialize in?
No, I'm a little too eccentric to stick with one design, although that would be a really good business move. Builders who tend to focus on one thing tend to do really well compared to the builders who focus on trying to do everything. But I fall into the latter category, which doesn't make any sense. My basic philosophy is be sensible. And this would apply to someone, one of your shop employees or salesman or a frame builder. You have to look at the person who is buying the bicycle. What sort of riding they're going to be doing. What is the person like at that time, and what will they be like in the future? That 28-year-old college racer who's so fast now is probably gonna get married, have kids, get slower, and maybe a little tire clearance and rack brazons would be a really good thing for him. Although he has no idea that he needs them yet.
Yeah, try and talk him into it though.
Right,
but that is your job. I agree. I at least to make those suggestions.
And the same thing on the 50-year-old cyclist who now the kids are off to college and such, and all of a sudden there's a little discretionary income and time to train. Well, you better get him a real bike.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of my thought process is try to be sensible. I like bikes that have a little bit. I was going to say better handling, but a little bit lower trail than the typical racing bike.
Yeah.
Not quite as extreme as the bicycle quarterly philosophy, but approaching that. I like wider tires.
Well, we're kind of all in line here. Greg rides a little wider tire than that 23 millimeter, and we tend to build bikes with wider tires. So I understand that, and they ride more comfortably. We'll start with comfort being, to me, an important part of a bicycle.
Absolutely. One of my big pet peeves is that so much of the bicycle design now is driven by the marketing department and not the people who are making the bikes, especially as a tube manufacturer. What we see has been made in the past, a lot of it doesn't make any sense. You're old enough to remember the old Alans and such, which were, somebody from that generation what an aluminum bike is like, they'd say, it's real soft and whippy. And,
right.
And then you ask their kids what aluminum's like, and it'll rattle your teeth out.
Well, right.
Which is it? Not the material, it's the design and marketing that's making all the difference.
So do you think today's bikes in general, and this is, of course, a huge generalization, but do you think today's production bicycles make a lot of sense or not? For the most part. I'm not going to talk about urban transportation bikes. I'm really talking about your sort of 700C wheel drop bar bike.
Yeah, for the most part, what people are getting for their dollar is absolutely amazing. Compared to the 60s or 70s or 80s, these bicycles are staggering. But they're also highly specialized. They're getting very, very good at doing one thing. And that becomes part of the problem, is that they're getting very expensive, and they're losing their ability to do multiple things. You try to take one of your best racing bikes out on a tour. Well, it's not very well designed for that at all. But if you take an old Richie Sachs out for a tour, it's going to work a lot better.
Right, right.
So the specialization, I think, is a little bit too far, and they've become very frail at the in an attempt to get the weight down, and that becomes a big problem because the mode of failure, how are these bikes breaking, is not by what's expected. Just about anything that we see on the road today is fairly safe for riding. It's the unexpected that causes issues. When you get a material with a little greater toughness, such as steel or titanium, they can handle a lot more of the unknown than carbon fiber because of the unidirectional strength of carbon fiber.
I'm going to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Wade Barossi. He's with Accel Corporation and Cycle Design, and that's what we're going to talk about next because that's what the direction we're heading in is tubing. Tell us who Accel is and what Cycle Design is.
Okay. That does get a little confusing.
Yeah, it did to me, but I kind of understand it. But
Accel is the company name, Accel Corporation.
Okay.
And in that company, we have three basic product lines. We have the Cycle Design products, and originally the company was called Cycle Design, but that really scared off a lot of our aerospace and non-cycle industry business because they thought, well, you're a bicycle stuff company.
Right.
So that was the big reason for the name change. Is now we can say, no, we don't only focus on bicycles, which is the truth. We do a fair amount with aerospace and optics and some things like that. And then beyond the cycle design, we also have my own frames, which, as small a part of that is, I still need them. Have the business end of things to cover.
So when we were in Philadelphia, you were explaining to me what you could do at Accel that seems to be different from what other tubing manufacturers can do. What is it that Accel can do?
Well, Accel really has what's probably the most modern tube-making equipment in the world. It was originally designed and purchased for the production of Cannondale tubing, which made all of for a number of years under a different company name, but same factory, same employees and such. And so we have a huge production capacity. Now, Cannondale, of course, was an aluminum company at that point. So we, you know, when your biggest customer asks for aluminum, you make lots of aluminum. But we also have the extensive capacities in steel and titanium as well.
You made a comment that Accel could do things with tubing that other brands can't. And so it's really the machines that can do this stuff.
Not only the machines.
Oh, okay.
There are other companies that have good equipment out there. But some of it is the structure. We're a very small company.
So
we also self-distribute. With most other companies, you have to work through a distributor who has these items in stock. And if they don't make that item, it becomes very cumbersome to get another one made, and involves conversations with the manufacturer and usually product minimums. Where I can just call the back room and say, Antonio, I need some longer tubes cut. And it's really cool because they do it.
Do you make things for like individual one-off builders as well as for companies?
We are working towards making that cost effective.
Okay.
But yes, that is the goal, to have a broad selection of tubing with reasonable quantities in stock for immediate delivery for the smaller builders, as well as retaining the ability to do larger custom runs for the larger manufacturers.
So I guess what I'm trying to get to is Accel is hoping to become like True Temper was?
Very much so. True Temper is a great company.
Right.
But they're not focused on bikes.
In fact,
to me, it seems like they're getting away from the bicycle end of things.
Yeah.
Which is really, really bad. I hope they don't. I see a big market void there, especially with aluminum, where there just isn't much other option.
Well, that's true. That's true. Are you seeing any backlash against imported goods that is sort of doing you a favor?
Oh, very much so.
Oh, good.
A lot of it tends to be the timing and communication process involved. Or when you're working with different cultures, you have language and significant cultural barriers in the way business is done. For example, in the U.S., somebody, you know, one of our customers calls and says, I need X product, and I need it in a hurry. Well, I pack it and ship it and send a bill, and can generally rely that, you know, the vast majority is just going to pay the bill without any problem.
Right.
It's an honor system, and it works. And that doesn't work worldwide.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess I didn't think about the financial part of it. Interesting.
And then, you know, time delays, and with the cost of overseas shipping getting rapidly higher, it gives some advantages to a local manufacturer.
Do you do any butting on your frames?
Absolutely.
You do? Okay. Okay, so I remember, I think it was Gary Klein did what he called gradient tubing, meaning it had some sort of a structure to it that wasn't just straight gauge throughout. Is that possible with aluminum, or is that something I made up?
No, absolutely. All of our aluminum tubing is butted. Also, we do a lot with tapering in various shapes. So,
nice.
So, you know, both arrow shapes and structural shapes and all kinds of stuff.
So who is building with aluminum today? I mean, can you tell me some of those people? Or you can say no if you can.
Sure. It's coming up quick. Spooky and FTW are two that come right to mind. And Turner and the Zen Fabrications, they build for a lot of different companies. And there's a group of smaller builders that are coming up too, that are building custom numbers of frames in aluminum. It's a very good material, and this is a new sort of an eye-opening experience for me, because I was not real fond of aluminum just a few years ago. But after working with it very extensively in the last couple of years, I've really come to a much greater appreciation of it and realized that a lot of the weaknesses are the marketing department, not the material.
Really? That's interesting, because I've always thought of aluminum, to make it strong enough, you had to make it pretty oversized and stiff.
No.
No? Huh.
Alons didn't break.
They
were just glued.
That's true. They were glued. Well, that's what we used to call them, screwed and glued. That's exactly right. I remember that. That's true. The Gorchody Alons and the original Alon, I guess they marketed them themselves when I think about it. We used to sell them. Actually, they were very light frames. Well, Vetus was another lightweight tubing, as I remember.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. We're going back a few years.
Oh, yes.
So what have you got that's going to be new for 2013? Do you have some new stuff?
Right now, the newest thing is going to be a new factory. We are...
Oh, cool.
It's necessary. We're downsizing. We don't need the huge space that was necessary for the Cannondale volumes. And we have this lovely factory on a beautiful riverfront property that really needs to be a nice restaurant or luxury condo and not an old, cruddy manufacturing building.
Yeah, it was. I remember when Canada, I think they also, before they even were producing bikes, were in that building doing soft goods for many years ago.
Yeah, this is a different facility.
Oh, it is. Same. Okay.
Yeah, well, this is in Shelton, Connecticut.
And so where is your new facility going to be?
Probably going to be in Hamden, Connecticut.
Yeah. And do you actually have a property picked out?
We do. We're in lease negotiations currently.
Yeah, that's...
And it'll probably take nearly 6 months for everything to be back up and in stock and such.
Any plans for a West Coast distribution, or are you going to just have it all come out of Connecticut?
I really don't know.
Okay.
Our West Coast distributor is Dave Bohm, who's a partner in Cycle Design.
Right.
And so he typically handles the West Coast end of things. For small builders, we'll probably end up having Dave have a good stock of the common items, and custom orders will probably come out of the East.
You doing any lugs?
We do not do lugs.
Okay.
It looks interesting. We can't add very much to what's been done right now. Between the existing offerings, there's some really good options out there.
So if people want to know more about Cycle Design and Accel, you want to give us the websites?
Sure.
Okay.
Accel is acceltube.com. That's A-C-E-L. And Cycle Design is cycledesignusa.com.
Okay.
And I'm the world's worst website guy. And frankly, it's not something I've wanted to put a ton of money into. I've focused on keeping the prices rational. So the websites are pretty disappointing. And at some point, we're going to get a web guy on board to handle that, but...
You know, these days I'm finding more information on Facebook than almost anywhere. Although I have to say, the good content on a website is always appreciated by thinking people.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. All right. Well, Wade, this has been enlightening. I mean, I knew about Accel. I saw you guys at NABS last year. That was the first I met up with you. And we did talk to Dave Bohm a little earlier this fall. And then I ran into you in Philadelphia. So it all came together. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening.
You're welcome. I also have one piece of news.
Oh, yes.
This coming weekend, December 1st, there is a bicycle engineering symposium at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic.
Really?
I'm one of the speakers at that, but it should be a fun event for anybody in the New York area.
Will they be doing any either videotaping or podcasting of it?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard.
Interesting. So people who want to find out about it could probably go to RPI's website and find out. Very cool. Yeah. What are you going to be speaking about?
Usual bicycle construction and design.
Yeah.
I'll probably harp on brazing because it's sort of my favorite sport. But, yeah, general construction, trying to get the engineers to think reasonably and not let the marketing guys drive them into a corner.
And how many people do you think will show up for this?
I really don't know.
Wow. Is this the first time they've done it?
No, I believe they did. They've had it once before.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Wade. I hope you guys have a really nice holiday and a great 2013 season.
You too, and thank you for hosting the show and everything. It's always a great time listening.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wade Barossi is the owner of Accel Tubing and also Cycle Design USA. He joined us from Shelton, Connecticut. Nice to see somebody carrying on the proud tradition of Cannondale-style tubing.
Among other things, that is correct. And I guess the purchase of all of the equipment, you know, they bought all that that big equipment. It's interesting that he's downsizing his factory. I think that's cool. Probably, I can't imagine how big that factory was, that Cannondale factory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm proclaiming that this coming Monday, or the Monday after you hear this podcast, as the case may be, is buy stuff and only stuff you need.
I like
Monday.
That. I'd like to see you get that one by the Hallmark people. I think that's a great idea.
We had Gray Thursday and Black Friday and Cyber Monday and Charity Tuesday and all the other days.
Small
really Business
funny.
Saturday. I'm not forgetting that one. But buy something you absolutely need
How
Monday.
How about a day where it's don't buy anything.
Oh, that's
Just
already
go out
been,
and ride your bike.
Buy nothing day is already.
Oh, it's past already.
Well, I don't know when it is, but that's a thing.
Well,
you're too late to the party with that one.
I can tell you. Oh, yeah. I'm always late to the party. I can tell you that I almost wrote my opening exactly like this. I'm glad I didn't because you got to end with it.
Well, buy nothing day is kind of a false thing because it's like, you know, don't buy gas on this particular day.
Right.
And that'll show the oil companies. Ha ha. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Sure.
But buy something you need or buy only what you need is just, you know, that philosophy makes sense. It's hard to stick to, though.
You
Those
know,
shiny objects are so attractive.
Yes, see, I'm not a shopper. I hate shopping.
I do too.
And
but
I'm not there's... a collector either. I don't like hoard things. I don't collect things. I'm one of these people. I'm just way too practical. What's wrong with me?
Well, whether you're a collector, a rider, a scrimper, or a saver, we hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks for hanging out with us. And we will see you back here next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.